It's Main Street on Prairie Public. Good Thursday to you. Nice to have you along. I'm Eric Deathridge. Hope you're recovering from that early April winter blast. Well, maybe you'd like to warm up to a hot espionage thriller. If that's your thing, you'll want to stick around for Matt Olien's movie review of Black Bag, starring Cate Blanchett and Michael Fassbender. And he'll share an appreciation of Iceman, of Jim Morrison, or at least a talented actor who played him. Anyway, the late, great Val Kilmer. Dave Thompson will lead off the second half of Main Street with his weekly review of North Dakota and surrounding region news. And speaking of news, we keep hearing about the shrinkage of newspapers across the country. And yes, while the business models of traditional quote-unquote papers have had to evolve in order to survive, we have a couple of guests who say, stop the presses. Allison Olam, editor of the Walsh County Press and president of the North Dakota Newspaper Association, and Amy Wabana, owner, editor, and publisher of the Foster County Independent and the New Rockford Transcript, join Prairie Public Director of Radio Ann Alquist for a conversation I'm sure you're going to enjoy.
Let's start with where the legislative session started, which was addressing property tax relief. Of course, the governor came right out of the gate to more than triple the tax credit. He also proposed, this was probably the most controversial part of his proposal, which was that cap, that 3% cap on local government spending property taxes, with the caveat of being able to roll it over. Allison, Walsh County has a population of just over 10,000. So what are some of the reactions from where you sit in Walsh County?
I think what we're hearing from our little corner of the state is that, you know, we're kind of on our own for a lot of things. So that property tax is vital to our communities. But at the same time, we're not seeing the kind of support from the state that's necessary in other places. So when we have major projects that come down the line from counties, local government, now it's just the counties are having to figure out how to make those work. Right now we have a couple of different school projects and a massive jail project on the agenda to be voted on in the next month or two. So we're really seeing that while property tax is great when you're campaigning, there's a lot of need for those funds. And without having any kind of auxiliary support from the state for programs like that, we're on our own.
I got a cup of coffee this morning. I get the same thing every day. And I saw that it had gone up. It was 5 cents. It wasn't a big deal. But it was a sales tax because the sales tax had gone up for, I think it was for the convention center that they passed in Fargo or something. But it did like make my ears perk up. And I did have a moment where I felt it, like I felt the local impact. I realize it's not property taxes, but that's the other area, right? Which is that if you can't get it from property taxes and they start looking at sales taxes, and there is a cap on that, but it was something that just kind of made me think like, oh yeah, this is what it feels like, you know, as a resident, you know, to pay for things. And of course in Fargo, you know, they're very eager to build it up as a convention center hub.
Yeah. And we're pretty limited to what funds we have available. Property tax is a big one. You're not just looking at your residential property tax. You're looking at land values. A lot of these farmers are doubled up. So
what about you, Amy? How does it look from Foster County and New Rockford?
In Foster and Eddy County, the commissioners are kind of having similar conversations. In fact, it's County Commission Day today. So both myself and one of my reporters were attending County Commission meetings. And the big concern from that perspective has been the cap. So the 3% cap, at one point there was a suggestion of a 2% cap even. And they're concerned that when you're looking at, for example, healthcare premiums for their staff at the county offices going up by 15% a year, they're saying that with this 3% cap, you know, inflation's 2.8% right now. At least that's the last number I heard. And there's beyond inflation, there's no room. And so if there's this cap in place, then they have to make hard decisions or going to have to make hard decisions about what they cut, because they'll have to cut something in order to keep all of their staff on healthcare. and be able to cover that health insurance premiums. For example, in Foster County, we wrote an article about it a couple of weeks ago at their last meeting, how one of the considerations was they may have to reduce a blade operator. In context, it means that they have to make these hard decisions, or will have to make these hard decisions about what they cut, because they have to cut something. And no matter what they do cut, if there is a cap put in place, there will be upset residents. Because yes, they want the property tax break, but they don't necessarily understand that there could be a loss of services that comes along with that, just because of the reality of where we are with the cost of things increasing at a higher, you know, rate.
What Allison was describing as well, you know, when that's a very reliable source of taxable revenue to, yeah, for the building project, to build the new jail, to fix the local school. The only other option you have without additional help from Bismarck is to cut.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to pivot to educational savings accounts, because this is something that I've been watching throughout the course of the legislature. And it's been making its way through. North Dakota is distinctive in that it's a handful of states that doesn't have charter schools, but it's also just been interesting to watch. The votes for educational savings accounts has been very close. They've been very close as it's gone through crossover, and is now being considered. It seems to be popular in larger areas like Bismarck and Fargo. That seems to be where the desire for educational saving accounts from. But I noticed that Representative Halstead, who's from Williston and a former public school teacher, he said, lose your community, lose your school, as he spoke in opposition. He's opposed to it. So I was curious to hear from you about, A, what role do schools play in your community? And B, how is the conversation playing out about educational savings accounts?
Well, I cover the Carrington School Board, and there were some conversations at the last meeting there. In Eddy County and in Foster County, we don't have private schools. We do have a number of homeschool families, and the local library provides a homeschool power hour, for example, for those homeschool families. And so there are some local resources being provided for those who are choosing something alternative from the public school system. But the vast majority of our residents, we rely on our public schools to educate our students, right? And the big conversation that was had in the past month is that public schools are required to educate every student, regardless of disability, regardless of ability to pay, all of those things, right? And they can't discriminate, right? They have to educate every one of them. And that takes a tremendous amount of financial resources. And so if you're taking any amount away from what they're getting to put it into something that doesn't even exist in our county, shouldn't those private schools have to comply by the same standards? Because right now they don't, right? And so the idea is that we don't want anything that would traditionally go to public schools to go away from them, right? If the state wants to put additional money into beyond what's already being provided for education at the level that's needed, that may be a different conversation. But to be transferring those same dollars away when there's a tremendous need, as it is, you know, schools are trying to pass tax levies to rebuild their buildings and to renovate, and they're failing at a high rate. I've been part of 3 school districts that have tried to pass special bond referendums in the past 3 years or increase in building funds, and the taxpayers are saying no. And so where does the money come from to keep providing that need? That's the big question, I think.
Also, you want to chime in about schools and your community? And I will also say, just as someone who moved here from a small rural Alaska borough, yeah, the schools, that's where the play that was put on. I mean, you would have thought Lin-Manuel Miranda had arrived. It was a 5th grade play. I mean, everybody showed up at that play because, you know, that's what you do in a town of 7,500 people. Like, we all go. Like, what are you going to do in Sitka, Alaska in February? You go see the 5th grade play, and it's at the school. And so I think about just the infrastructure, like you were talking about buildings, Amy. I think about the community infrastructure that schools provide as well, physical conveners for political town halls, for the play, for community entertainment. Allison, I'd love to hear from you about schools in Walsh County.
We're in an area where our schools are quite small. In comparison, we're on the smaller end of things. We're doing the best with what we have. A lot of our schools are living and dying by the funding formulas that they're provided by the state. This is kind of one of those situations where you look at the classroom sizes and you look at the education they're getting. Our students are getting an excellent education. And that is something that I would fight anybody on, is that these rural towns, they sit and try to compare the different levels of our Class A, Class B, whatever definition you want to give it, and then you throw private schools in the mix. I think we're doing an excellent job of educating our kids, and I think they're getting a lot of different opportunities. But again, it all comes down to the resources that we have available. And so that's one of the biggest challenges. If you're taking away those resources, what are the kids left with?
Talk a little bit briefly about term limits, because I've been following this thread as well. You're about the average, Allison. It's about 10,000 people is about half the state living in communities, about 10,000 to 15,000 people. And so term limits, it just seems like you'd run out of people at some point.
That's kind of the question, isn't it? Like, if you don't run out of people, you're going to run out of people that understand the process and know what they're supposed to be doing. I think there's probably a sweet spot when it comes down to it. There's some people who end up sitting in their spot way too long. But when you keep the limit to as small as some of these conversations have been including, what are we even giving them a chance to learn?
And especially when the legislative session is every 2 years.
It's every. Exactly. It's
You get
every
like a
2 years.
trial run and then you get prime time.
I mean, even just this year through the North Dakota Newspaper Association, all of the different bills we've been tracking, it's not something that I'm used to. It's almost an education in itself trying to lobby for these things.
Term limits are, it was popular. Obviously, it passed by a decent margin here, and that was no different in my area. We have long-standing legislators in both districts that my newspaper serves. You know, we're talking legislators that have been in their positions for more than 2 decades. So one side, you know, to look at the other side of things on those that support it is that there may be some people that are discouraged from running because they have to go up against a legislator that, I mean, we've had the majority leader in our district, you know, in Carrington, we had Chet Pollard. We have Don Vigasaw now and Robin Weiss. So we're talking very long-standing legislators. And so there's certainly some conversations about discouraging people because they feel like they don't have a chance, if you will, against someone who has that much experience. And yes, there's a lot to be said for experience, and we do have experienced, capable legislators serving us in our districts. That's not the question. It's that, are we going to open up some opportunity for new leaders to come in? I think that remains to be seen what will happen here in a few years.
Yeah, how do we manage our democracy? Yeah, in a way that's fair, but also, make sure that we've got the experience that can be developed over time. Since we're talking about legislators, I would be remiss if I didn't ask about a formerly powerful former state senator, Ray Holmberg. The sentencing hearing came down. He was well loved in his district of Grand Forks. I saw some of his supporters at the sentencing hearing at the federal courthouse in Fargo last week. I'm curious about, from where you're sitting, in New Rockford in Walsh County, the impact of that announcement about getting a 10-year sentence.
I actually did an interview with you guys about a year ago, and it was not too long after he was initially, the charges were filed against him. And we discussed that we'll see how the facts bear out in the case. And now here we are, right? And the impact and the things that we've learned that have happened. And then there's the implication of our former attorney general who has since passed away and former staff members. It definitely has reverberated across the state. Is it something we're talking about in New Rockford and Eddy County, you know, in New Rockford and Carrington? Not so much beyond the fact that I think there was some real concern with the recommended sentence of 3 years that had come from the DA's office. I thought that was, I think that was the biggest conversation that I had had locally was 3 years, that's it, when we know what the evidence says. And so I think the 10-year sentence was definitely an improvement over the recommendation. I think that was certainly something that people supported. I don't know that our legislators in our districts were real close with Ray. I guess that's where I can leave it. And if they are, or if they were, they're probably keeping their distance and not talking about it. And maybe I might be wrong.
Well, let's talk about media, because North Dakota newspapers, Prairie Public, we've been in the news with bills. So in the past, we've gotten an appropriation. I think lesser known, I work in public broadcasting. We're often in the crosshairs of questions about whether or not we should receive state or federal funding. But there's a bill that would affect newspapers that has worked its way through. A couple bills, as I understand it, that did not make it through. So Allison is the president of the North Dakota Newspaper Association Board. Tell us about this bill and why it's concerning.
There's been a few this session that have been concerning for us. One that was defeated quickly early on was one regarding publication of county minutes. We had one that went through with good support, which would reinforce the law that requires insurance companies to publish their abstracts. And now the one that is a little more probably what you're referring to would be 2069 with the publication of public notices on the Secretary of State website.
The idea is that it would be a backstop because there was, and I think the way the executive director explained it to me, she's like, literally on one hand, I could count how many times a newspaper, failed to publish. And it was because, someone went on vacation or the state didn't get it to them in time.
Right. So this was brought up by the Public Service Commission, and they are required to publish, when they're working on these massive projects. And with the publication dropping that one time, it can hold up things and it can cause concerns, which is why they wanted to have a backstop system, essentially, on the Secretary of State's website. I guess at this point, one of our main arguments is that if you want a backstop to it, why would you turn to the Secretary of State's website when that's something we can provide?
And already do. I believe it's ndpublicnotices.com. I think that's
the top of the Google searches. So
the Secretary of State is opposed to this bill. He testified.
He did. He testified in opposition to this bill. That was kind of a huge support for what we had in this committee meeting. To have the Secretary of State say, hold up, this isn't exactly what our job is here. And then to have us in the room going, this is our job. I think that might have made the impact we were looking for.
And also the Cecile Wehrman, the executive director, in her testimony, this goes right to the public's right to know.
Exactly.
And if you have the government in the position, there's no check. There's no check and balance on what the public is getting to know.
Exactly. There's a few of those legislators who love to use those little sayings, but fox in the hen house is definitely what comes to mind. Why are you in charge of this when there already is a checks and balances in place? That's kind of the rundown on some of these public notice concerns that have been top of mind this session.
Let's talk about the state of newspapers in North Dakota. There's a Bush Foundation grant to assess the the state of, the health of, financially, digitally, philosophically, spiritually. It's going to do like all the things, surveys, focus groups about the state of newspapers and local news in general. It's not just about newspapers, but about local news consumption in North Dakota. I mean, I got to ask, what keeps you showing up to work every day? I mean, you're on the front lines. What keeps you coming to work in the morning and why you're optimistic about the future of newspapers in North Dakota and local news in general?
Yeah, because it's such a low stress, high income job, right, Amy?
Yeah, I might need a little bit of time to think about this. No, I'm just kidding.
Because I love my community. I mean, I do it because of the people that came before me, and they paved the way for, you know, at least in my situation, the Walsh County Press has always been just an amazing, outstanding place where, you know, we've got all these archives of history that just wouldn't exist without them.
Well, and I do want just want to take this moment to recognize and honor LaVon Erickson. I never met her, but I'll call her a colleague. And she had her service recently, and they found an owner for the paper, the Ducats, and they had their first edition. And so the Renville County farmer lives on.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, when you look at how are newspapers doing? And yeah, it's so easy to talk about the newspapers that we've lost. But the reality is that our communities are changing. And so we need to change with that, right? So there's digital, there's social media, there's all the things, right? There's the podcasts and the, you know, all these different ways now where you can get information. But for the vast majority of the things that I cover in my community and that Allison covers in her community, no one else is doing it. Okay. It's easy. Yes. So we had state archery and we had state basketball tournament in Minot on the same weekend, just a week ago. And my daughter and I went, and it was 3 long days in Minot, nights in the hotel, whatever. And of course, it was all over who won the state basketball tournament and who made the all tournament team and who Mr. Basketball is and whatever, right? State basketball is well covered by lots of media, right? On the other hand, I was the one that was solely responsible for covering the state archery tournament. This is something that draws 1,000 kids, nearly 1,000 kids. And it doesn't get the headlines. When we posted how our kids did, we were the first and the only to post about which kids made nationals and the fact that we had 2 state champions within our school districts in the counties that I serve.
And also, as someone who's done genealogical research to learn more about my grandfather, who never talked about his childhood as a poor Irish American kid, when I found that newspaper article about the award that he won for outstanding academic achievement at his Catholic high school in New London, Connecticut, it was like the greatest feeling in the world. So I think about someone 50 years, 80 years, 100 years finding that archive of grandma's archery tournament, and this, like, this whole world opens up about who that person was.
And that's what keeps me going to work every day, is knowing that at some point in the future, someone is going to be opening up one of these archives. You know, it's probably going to be digital and online and searched and whatever. And that's okay, mm-hmm. too, right? We have those things, yeah. Now. We have archives and they are being digitized. We have up to 1979 of the Foster, every newspaper ever printed in Foster County. We have every edition archived online, thanks to the Historical Society and benefactors. And so those are the things. And that is why I do what I do. And that's why newspapers aren't going anywhere. We're not dying. We might have to roll with some punches and start doing more digital stuff for now. But the majority, I will tell you, the majority of my readers, 80% of them at least get the print edition, and most of them solely the print edition. And yes, it's growing that digital audience, and we're capturing more people by being online, but the vast majority of our eyes are still on that print product. And we have to stay relevant, we have to stay current, and we have to move along with our audience. And that's what we're doing with this grant, is helping us better understand the communities that we're serving, mm-hmm. so that we can continue to serve them in the way that they want to be. And in that regard, we're not going anywhere.
It goes in cycles. You know, we're not losing newspapers. People always come back around to it. I think if I look in my archives right now from the 80s, it's going to say, oh no, the end is near. And if you go back a little farther, it's going to say, oh no, the end is near. But it just, at some point, you go, well, it's been how many issues and we're still here. We're still kicking. Our death is greatly exaggerated.
That's Allison Olam and Amy Wabana, two rural North Dakota editors who say their newspapers are alive and kicking. On the way, Dave Thompson breaks down the week's news out of the legislature and more. And Matt Olean reviews the spy thriller Black Bag, starring Kate Blanchett and Michael Fassbender. He'll also pay tribute to Val Kilmer, Batman, Iceman, and inhabitor of Jim Morrison's spirit, it would seem. If you ever watched the Doors movie by Oliver Stone, you'll know what I mean. Stay tuned. That's all coming up.
Extra, extra, read all about it.
Time for our weekly news chat with Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson, who's got the latest from North Dakota's 69th legislative session and much more. Hey, Dave.
Hi, Eric.
Now, Dave, I think it would be accurate to say that you and I didn't have smartphones growing up.
Well, that's an absolute accurate statement.
That's truth in reporting right there. So we'll just have to imagine and get inside the heads of what it's like to be a kid who has one, who no longer can stay connected during school hours. So describe this House bill, 10-11-60, that's getting kicked around and added to in the Senate Education Committee.
That is correct. What they're doing is what they call a bell-to-bell prohibition, meaning the school bell rings to start the day. You have to turn your phone in. It just can't be off. It has to be stored away for a while. When the bell rings at the end of the day, you get your phone back. They don't want it to disrupt class, and then they're worried that, you know, some kids are having some bad reactions to social media.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt, you know, there's a lot of studies that say, and I think we could use our common sense too, that a lot of social media usage can have some negative tolls on our mental health,
right,
and the self-image of kids and adolescents. But, I mean, it's also just sort of part of everyday life and communication. Any pushback on this bill?
There's some pushback, but it isn't legislative pushback yet. When the bill gets to the floor, it's going to be interesting to listen and watch that debate to see if there is pushback. There are carve-outs in this bill that will allow, if you have medical needs or if you are expecting a very serious phone call from parents, then they will allow you to have your cell phone with you as long as it's muted, and you just answer it if you get notifications, shaking or something like that.
Yeah, a vibration or whatnot. I guess the proof eventually will be in testing, right? If the test scores go up when cell phones are not sort of attached to the kids, then maybe there's something there.
That's exactly right. They want kids to pay attention in class, and they're hoping this will help.
Well, Dave, I had to laugh because there's a bill that you reported on this morning that would prohibit someone from publishing false information in a political ad. I mean, at the very least, distorted, exaggerated disinformation, some might say. Isn't that the hallmark of political ads that we know and loathe?
That is true, and say the truth can be stretched a little thin at times. But if somebody wants to take the time, take a case to a prosecutor and say, hey, this was absolutely false, and it shouldn't have been published in my opponent's ad against me, well, then they can try to prosecute it. And this makes it a misdemeanor, but still you have to have the proof that there was intent and that it actually was published. There's still a lot of concern about a few things. Just as an example that was used in testimony, after Julie Fedorchuk won the Republican nomination for U.S. Congress, there was a text message going around saying that she was withdrawing from the race, which was generated by some out-of-state company or firm that didn't like her. And the truth was, no, she was not dropping out of the case.
Now, speaking of vetoes, fill us in on this one, because I heard the other day that Governor Armstrong had a veto that was overridden. Can you explain that?
Well, it had to do with tax breaks concerning Rough Ride Industries, which is the prison industry where the prisoners actually make office furniture. So there was going to be a special tax break if you bought some stuff. And the governor didn't like that. He vetoed it. Well, the House overturned it. But still, there has to be the other chamber to overturn it. Well, so it is overturned by one House. We still are pending in the other House.
So you think Governor Armstrong's background as a defense attorney may have played into that?
Possibly. And that's one thing I was thinking about when he vetoed the bill. But I think it's a matter of, you know, if you carve out this kind of tax breaks, what other tax breaks are you going to carve out in prison industries?
So, Dave, you had a story on this morning, I heard it on the way in, from Mike Moen of the Prairie News Service about regional pushback to President Trump and more specifically Elon Musk's dismantling of services in the federal government. For those who didn't hear this morning, can you kind of catch us up on that?
Here's what's going on. This weekend, there are going to be mass protests all over the upper Midwest. And I'm thinking Fargo and Bismarck and maybe Grand Forks and Minot, too, will see some protests basically saying that their argument is the cuts seem to be just kind of willy-nilly, and there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to some of these cuts and some of these job losses. Some people, you know, and this has been documented by reports, that some of the people who lost their jobs had stellar job records, but then they were told that they were underperforming.
Right, right.
So
that was sort of the standard email that would come out, right? You were underperforming at your work, and therefore we are letting you go. And it just seemed like a form letter that had nothing to do with the actual individual.
That's correct. And that's why these cases have gone to court. So I think this is a prelude. There probably will be more cases going to court.
Have you heard anything about residents being particularly concerned about their Social Security checks or Medicaid or at the VA office? Are lines or waits longer there now for people to get services with some of the layoffs? What have you been hearing?
Here's what I've talked to Fargo legislators, because the VA hospital is there, and this is both Republicans and Democrats. They're hearing a lot of worry from the veterans who are receiving care of the VA hospitals. So far, it hasn't impacted them too much, but they're worried about longer wait times or having to wait to have services. So there is some concern in the air. Also, there's some concern about the loss of jobs there, too, in the VA. And I've heard, shall we say, talk in the hallways that they're worried about what might happen with Social Security. And this is both parties. I'm not just talking about Democrats.
Yeah, sure. But it's bipartisan. Mm-hmm. Republicans and Democrats receive Social Security checks after a certain age. That is for sure. It's a big top of mind concern for millions of people, certainly many in North Dakota.
Absolutely.
As well. If you're just joining us, it's the weekly news chat with our news director, Dave Thompson. I'm Eric Detheridge. Well, Dave, North Dakota is number one in a lot of great quality of life things, but it's also number one in something we'd rather it not be. North Dakota has the highest incidence of radon, a colorless, odorless, radioactive gas in the nation. Katie David had a story on this, and this really got my attention, Dave. A UND School of Medicine expert was testifying at the legislature that 10% of homes in Grand Forks have radon gas equal to 2 packs of cigarettes a day.
Right.
And he said there was one home in Grand Forks that had the equivalent of 320 cigarettes a day. I mean, that blew my mind. I know that North Dakota has this, deserved reputation for high radon levels, but that just really got my attention. But there's a bill that did get a do pass recommendation from the committee. What would this bill do?
This bill would say that a seller has to disclose to the potential buyer of a property, whether it be a house or a building, that there is radon gas in there. Yet the weird thing is that the bill does not specify testing, but they're thinking this may lead to more radon testing and having more radon detectors put in homes and buildings just to make sure that people are safe.
Well, I mean, that's the point I think they were making, too. Of course, we would have smoke detectors to detect, fires, but why wouldn't we have radon detectors? And, of course, the big question is, if you do get those, high readings, what do you do as a homeowner next? I imagine that would involve some expense.
There are going to be some expense, too, but there are radon kits that are available through the North Dakota Health Department and some other things that will help mitigate the situation. I think they come with some cost, but it's not a high cost. But if you have huge radon levels, you might be talking about building projects, and there comes the price tag right there.
Well, Dave, we had some snow across the region this week, and that's good. That's a good thing. And yeah. Combined with some rain, you know, there's some moisture seeping into the ground, which we desperately need. Where is North Dakota right now in terms of projected drought and even with the wildfire season possibly?
See, that's just it. You know, we're still in the parlance of being dry. And there are some areas where you're in at least moderate drought in North Dakota. The snow probably helps somewhat, and the rain that came along with it is going to help somewhat. But a gauge I use is the Missouri River traffic. Mm. And the Missouri River management, the Corps of Engineers, is saying that the Missouri is going to be down this year. So that's the concern. And we've already seen wildfires in the Watford City area. So it's something to watch again. I hope it's not as bad as last year. That was just heartbreaking. All those wildfires out there.
Yeah, we had some tragedies last year. And let's hope that is not the case this year. But I know that's something that you and your news team will be keeping a sharp eye on. Oh, yeah. At least we're not talking floods this year as we often do in April. So that's one good side of the coin. You know, we live with this weather. We live with these conditions here in North Dakota. That's part of life up in this wonderful part of the world. Dave Thompson is our wonderful, awesome news director. Dave, thanks as always.
You bet, Eric.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather around, everybody.
There's a fanfare we look forward to each and every Thursday here on Main Street. It's our time to go to the movies with our good friend, Matt Olean. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Hi, Craig.
Matt, this week is a spy thriller. You're right in my wheelhouse. These are the types of movies I like. Let's listen to the trailer for Black Bag.
Where are you off to?
Black Bag.
To be with someone in this business, you each know what you know and you never discuss certain things. I would do anything for you.
Would you?
Yes.
You've got a breach.
One of our people stole something.
You cannot imagine the damage. Find the leak.
Give me 2 weeks.
Thousands of innocent people will die.
Okay. 1 week. Who's the suspect?
Your wife.
When you can lie about everything, how do you tell the truth about anything?
You think this is normal? The way you're doing this.
Maybe this is all your greatest game, George.
It's a very dangerous line of work.
I'll say.
Okay, Matt, we've heard the trailer. This is a sleek, stylish thriller with a married couple and a lot of drama. What did you think of the movie?
And you talked about spy thrillers, espionage. Nobody likes espionage like the Brits, right, Craig? They love espionage. They're just experts at it, MI6, all that stuff. And, of course, a lot of famous writers, Ian Fleming, John le Carré, have written, you know, British writers, Len Deighton as well, have written spy thrillers over the years. And so this film is more le Carré than Bond, I would say. What I mean by that is there's not a lot of action in this movie. It's about British intelligence people working, but it feels more like Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. If you remember that book and that film, there's a lot of talking. There's a lot of kind of... who's the mole? Who's the person that's leaked this document to the Russians or whoever has got it? So there's a lot of kind of intrigue as to what's going on. Steven Soderbergh is the director, an American director who's won the Oscar for Traffic back in 2000, and he directs a cast of British notables, notably Michael Fassbender and Cate Blanchett. They played married British intelligence workers. Also, there's good supporting performance from Naomi Harris, Tom Burke, Reggie Jean Page from Bridgerton fame, and Marisa Abella, who has a really good supporting performance in this. Fassbender and Blanchett are married in the movie. And essentially, Pierce Brosnan, who runs this unnamed British intelligence agency, has determined, or someone's determined, that a classified document called Severus has been leaked to people that shouldn't have this. And Michael Fassbender has to try to find out who has leaked it among the six actors that I've just named for you, including his wife, Kate Blanchett, who may be a suspect in this. It's a slow-to-start film, and the script is a bit confusing to start with, but eventually I kind of caught up with things. And I will say Soderbergh leaves well-disguised clues as to who is the person who's the traitor to the British government here. And when I look back over the film and once we figure out who it is, boy, it's hard to spot who the traitor is. And so it's not one of those obvious, oh, yes, that's the person. I should have known that all along. There's a big finale in this movie. But eventually, this is only a 93-minute movie. So Soderbergh, in typical Soderbergh style, directs economically, lean, and entertaining. And it might not be in his masterpiece canon, like with Traffic, Aaron Brockovich, Out of Sight, Contagion, Side Effects, but it's right in that next level, I would say. And that my good friend that went with me, she liked it as well. I think I liked it a little bit better after I had time to think about it. But it's a short film. It is so short, you almost think maybe it needed 10 more minutes to kind of flesh things out. But Fassbender's good. He is the guy who kind of can tell when people are lying in the movie. That's his specialty. Kate Blanchett, sultry and slick, who might be out for Pierce Brosnan's job. We don't know. And all the supporting people are interesting as well. And you just kind of have to figure out what's going on here. But Soderbergh keeps it going. I wouldn't say it's a great film, but it's a very solid Steven Soderbergh film. And let me say, too, about Soderbergh, Craig. I think he's the most underrated, underappreciated American director of my time. Despite winning an Oscar, he never really gets kind of talked about with Tarantino or David Fincher or Christopher Nolan or Paul Thomas Anderson. And I'm not sure why, except that he makes really entertaining movies. He doesn't necessarily have a point of view. I don't know if he's an auteur. You know, auteur was the word coined by Andrew Saras years ago to describe directors who had this personal vision. And Saras famously kind of took down William Wyler and Fred Zinnemann way back in the day because they didn't have a personal vision, according to him, but they made all kinds of genres. And Soderbergh makes all kinds of genres, but he does specialize in kind of these mysteries and what's going on and a lot of multiple plots going on. So I liked it. Still playing at the Fargo Theater, still playing at the Cineplex if you want to go catch it. But Fassbender and Blanchett are so good together, you kind of wish they'd kind of do like a Thin Man series where they kind of, solve mysteries. That's how good they are together.
Can this become a franchise, Matt?
Oh, I doubt that. I was just kind of, riffing that I'd love to see Fassbender and Blanchett kind of play William Powell and Myrna Loy in the Thin Man series because I think they'd be pretty effective together. But Soderbergh will continue to crank films out. He cranks films out at a faster rate than any modern director that I know. Which maybe is why he doesn't quite get the credit he deserves, because he just keeps churning them out. But he is a fast worker, I must say, very fast compared to some slow workers like Stanley Kubrick was and David Lean and some people like that.
Just a quick reminder, Matt, you open your Brando film series this weekend at the Fargo Public Library.
Yeah, Saturday, 2 p.m., and it'll be three Saturdays in April, and then we skip a week, and then May 3rd is the final installment. These are free. And what I'm doing is kind of running some Brando films that maybe people haven't seen. We assume everyone's seen The Godfather and On the Waterfront and A Streetcar Named Desire. Last Tango in Paris might be a little too raunchy for our library crowd, so we're not running that one. But we start with The Men this Saturday, which was his first film. People kind of think Streetcar was his first movie coming off Broadway, but it was not. It was The Men, where he plays a paraplegic war veteran, directed by the aforementioned Fred Zinnemann, who I mentioned earlier. And then we have Guys and Dolls. Laurie West at the library wanted that one, where Brando sings in quotation marks. I think his singing is fairly passable, though, although he co-stars with Sinatra here. Then we have Sayonara, April 19th, and finally Reflections in a Golden Eye on May 3rd.
Matt, I've done my sleuthing relative to Academy Award trivia.
Okay.
List two spy movies that have won Best Picture.
Ooh, two spy movies that have won Best Picture. Boy, our listeners are going to hate me for kind of humming through some dead air here. Oh, I should know this, shouldn't I? Boy.
I'll give you the English Patient.
Oh, English Patient. Yeah, yeah.
1996.
Can you give me some years?
Okay, 2012.
Oh, Argo, of course, with Ben Affleck. Yeah, I should have got that one.
All right, we've been to the movies with Matt Olean. Matt, have a great week.
You too. And I also want to make mention of a notable passing in the movie world, and that, of course, is Val Kilmer. Earlier this week, died at age 65. He'd been suffering from throat cancer for about a decade and kind of soldiered on, and 3 years ago had that cameo as Ice in Top Gun Maverick using kind of a voice-activated box that he was using. But wonderful actor, had the hard-to-work-with tag that followed him pretty much his whole career, but he left us with some indelible performances, especially Jim Morrison in The Doors, I think, and he is the best Doc Holliday of all the OK Corral films. He is the best Doc Holliday in Tombstone, 1993, opposite Kurt Russell. Really interesting actor, had movie star looks, but could kind of disappear into roles like he did in The Saint, played Batman, of course, in kind of an unsuccessful Batman film, and of course, Iceman in the Top Gun movies. Val Kilmer, dead at 65.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, and I'm from a small town in North Dakota, so community is pretty important to me. And so is knowing the scoop. Like about Phyllis's sauerkraut dinner coming up on Saturday in the church basement, or the local theater group's production this summer. That kind of thing. If you want to know what's going on, or you want to let people know what's happening in your neck of the woods, go to our community calendar at prairiepublic.org. You can learn all about exciting events across the region and get our listening audience-wise to your organization's events. Just go to prairiepublic.org/community.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Warning, this Dakota Datebook contains descriptions of graphic violence. This is Dakota Datebook for April 3rd. George Hanekek was born in Denmark in 1886 and came to North Dakota in 1910. In 1916, he had a run-in with the law when he attacked and tried to kill a girl in Minot. He was found guilty and sentenced to 3.5 years in prison. After being discharged in 1918, he opened a painting shop in Bismarck. It seemed he had changed. He was a quiet man who kept to himself and caused no trouble. He did some painting at the police office and even became friends with some officers. While he was never a police officer, he was occasionally sworn in to assist the department when extra help was needed. When Hanekek's past became known, Bismarck residents objected to his involvement with the police. He was asked to stay away, and shortly after, he left the city. He found work as a handyman on the Albertson farm near Baldwin. Mr. Albertson described him as morose and said he wouldn't eat with the family. He added that his daughter didn't like having him around, but he insisted he hadn't made any advances on her. Neighbors, however, said he had annoyed her. It all came to a tragic end. Albertson had left the farm to get a load of coal, leaving his daughter alone with Hanekek. Ellen was sitting at a desk writing a letter to a boy she knew at Valparaiso University in Indiana when Hanekek killed her. There were signs that she fought back, but she was no match for him. Hanekek must have realized Albertson would be returning soon. He took a shotgun and rifle from near the door and retreated to the hayloft of the barn. He may have planned to make a stand when a posse came for him, but likely knew he wouldn't be able to defend himself. When the posse discovered Hanekek, he was already dead. On this date, in 1923, the Albertson family, along with neighbors, gathered at their home for the funeral of Ellen Albertson. It would have been her 20th birthday. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Elton John reached out to singer-songwriter Brandi Carlile to propose making an album together. The thing is, they only had 20 days to finish it.
And we didn't know what was going to happen. We had nothing. But that's what excited me. I didn't want to know what was going to happen.
We speak with Elton John and Brandi Carlile about their new album, Who Believes in Angels, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Thursday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us today. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or you can subscribe to Main Street on your favorite podcast player. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. His topic, what can we do to improve legal immigration? And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again next week right here on Main Street.